Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. In 1943, the production of Oklahoma opened on Broadway based on Lynn Riggs' 1931 play, Green Grass, Green Grow the Lilacs. Oklahoma was the first musical that composer Richard Rodgers and librettist Oscar Hammerstein created together. The story takes place in 1906 in Oklahoma Territory when cowboy Curly McLean and a lonely farmhand Jed Fry both compete to try to convince a farm girl named Laurie Williams to go to the Box Social Dance. The musical was the first to blend song and dance with the plot, and songs that are iconic, like What a Beautiful Morning and I Can't Say No. On stage and screen, Oklahoma has often been portrayed as innocent and idyllic. In Daniel Fish's latest production, the director does not change any of the songs or the book, yet the tone and the characters feel completely transformed in this gripping, intense, and sometimes dark production. This is no small part due to the performances in the show, actors who show the dangerous and sinister side of prairie life. Oklahoma is running at St. Anne's Warehouse in Dumbo through November 11th. It's completely sold out, but some tickets might be available at the door, at least according to the website. No, I saw this in person. People lurking by the box office for that ticket. It was a little rough out there, actually, for a while. Rebecca Naomi Jones, who starts as Laurie, is here. Hi.
Hi.
Allie Stroker, who is Adoani, is here. Hi.
Hello.
And Mary Test, who plays Aunt Ella. Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Welcome to All of It. So this is one of those things where my friend who I went to see it with texted me yesterday, goes, I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of show. And Daniel Fish told The Times he wasn't about trying to push the show, but trying to really hear it.
Yes.
So how does that apply to your character, Mary?
Well, it applies to all of us in that with any show, you have to listen. But very often, you don't. You sort of are waiting for the time when you say your line. But in this particular show, it's very helpful to sit and listen and be sort of as real as possible. And be slow and methodical. And that seems to bring out a lot of the undercurrents of what's going on in this particular production.
Sure, because Aunt Eller is like kind of a boss in this.
Yeah, it's Aunt Eller, by
the
way.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Aunt Eller.
I know, I'm from the East Coast and I say aunt too, so it's hard.
Yeah, but she's like a boss in a way, like almost like
a
crime boss towards the end
Well, sort of, yeah. But it's all about circling the wagons.
She wants to make sure she takes care of her people.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly.
How do you think that Laurie is different in this production than in the sort of the traditional production for you?
Well, I think an issue with the way, or an issue that we see with the way that this musical is often performed is that we unfortunately gloss over a lot of the text with, you know, song and dance and pretty things and as Mary said, not listening. And so I think because of the fact that in our production we're really sitting in chairs, listening and talking and investigating this text in a more honest way, and because Daniel really didn't want us to sort of define what time period we're in. It's not like we're saying this is now or we're saying this is 75 years ago. We're just sort of existing as we are, people in this room saying these words to each other. What has happened for me is that I, Rebecca / Laurie in 2018, being in the middle of these scenes and listening to other people and actually a lot of it is in the moments where I don't have something to say, where I'm in the middle of a scene with other actors and actors are talking about Laurie in front of Laurie, but not including Laurie in that conversation. I very naturally start to wonder, why isn't Laurie speaking? Why doesn't she have something to say? And part of that is a question for the original text. Like, why didn't you write something for her? Mm-hmm. But also, you know, what does that mean for her internally? And so I think that has informed our version of the production because I think Laurie has a lot to say and has a lot to think and feel, and even when I'm not saying it or expressing it broadly, it's inside of me. And so I think that that has made her stronger amidst all of this unknowing that she's going through throughout the play.
Yeah, you get the sense that she has a rich internal life.
Yeah.
That she's thinking about everything that these men are saying about her.
Yes.
And about the time she's in.
Yes.
And that, you know, I thought, like, oh, she's a feminist, actually.
Yes.
Her position about going to this dance is she's taking the feminist position. I'm going to go with who I want to go, with whom
yes.
I want to go, and I'm going to decide when I want to decide.
Yes, and I think it's really complicated for her because of the fact that we do also exist in the world of the play as it was written. There's a lot that she knows that she's not allowed to feel that she does feel. And so I think there is this part of her that's taking the feminist edge to it all, but it's also scary for her, and it's not allowed and it's forbidden, and so I think there's just an inner turmoil happening there.
Same for Ato Annie. She's just feeling herself, like she's feeling her sexuality, and she's not really that apologetic about it.
Absolutely.
As you were developing the character, what kind of conversations did you have with Daniel?
I think, well, we had many conversations about this character, but I think what is interesting about working on a character like Ato Annie in 2018 is her theme song is "I Can't Say No." And we are living in this time where women are speaking out about how important it is to say no. And sometimes I have this inner conflict in me of, like, you know, who is this person? And as an actor, it's so important not to judge who you're playing. And I love playing Ato Annie every night because she genuinely doesn't know the answers yet. And she's trying to figure it out. And when she asks a question, in so many of the productions, you see Ato Annie and she can be played so easily as like an airhead.
A ditz, yeah.
Right. And something that I really have tried to stay true to about, you know, Ato Annie in this production is that she just is exploring. So the questions are really, she really wants an answer. She doesn't know, and it's not a caricature. It's a woman who doesn't know and who is celebrating and enjoying exploring her sexuality.
Sarah Holden, the Vulture at New York Magazine, wrote this about your two characters, about Laurie and Ato Annie. They appear not as opposites, but as different shades of intense female desire. And the play they inhabit becomes about domestication of that desire, about men's attempts to define, possess, and control it via a binding legal union.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring true to you guys?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Why?
Because I think there's so much fire in both of these women, and they're both figuring it out and figuring that out for themselves, not even as it pertains to these men. And yet, these men are talking about getting these women, owning these women, having these women.
And driving their stories. And I think what is so cool about working on a traditional piece in this kind of way is that we are allowed to bring our own beliefs and our own truth to these people. And for me, and you know, Laurie and Ato Annie and Ann Eller have scenes together. And when we sing Many a New Day together,
mm-hmm.
it's so exciting to represent these women in maybe a different way than they have before. And I think it's an important piece to be doing right now.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Ali Stroker, Rebecca Naomi Jones, and Mary Testa about the new version of Oklahoma that's at St. Anne's Warehouse. And Mary, tell us a little bit about, the staging is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So you feel like you're in like a barn or like a tractor pull kind of. It's but
yes.
It's very stark and
it's
very
kind of like
open.
A VFW hall.
Yeah, with stadium seating,
mm-hmm.
And everything's very blonde wood.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of your performance, how does the set, what impact does that have on your performance?
Well, in many ways, it's kind of relaxing in that we can sit, we're in the room. Daniel says this all the time. We're all, the community is in the room.
Mm.
So there's no time when you are not listening or experiencing someone else's story. That sort of makes the community stronger in a way. So it's relaxing because we're sitting, but it's also, it's weird to say relaxing. It's probably not the right word, but it's relaxing because there's so much backstory that's going on that you can live that backstory and enrich the story that's happening. So I find that kind of relaxing in a way, mm-hmm. that I'm not pressured to give some kind of performance. I can rely on all of this backstory that I've created to give it an authentic read, to give it an authentic reaction. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. How about for you two? What does the staging allow for you to do different than maybe a more traditional setting for Oklahoma?
I will say it does feel like it focuses the room. Mm-hmm. It feels like because we're all, audience included, just sitting there in what feels like a community room, in what feels like a conversation, that it feels like it just centers everyone in the same place, physically and also just in our minds, just ready for the task at hand, which is to have this conversation about this community. But I will say it's really funny to hear you use the word relaxing. Because
I know, it's probably not the right word.
Because I feel the absolute opposite. Like, I feel that the room, at least I felt this way when we first started rehearsing in there and the rainbow-colored fringe came down into the room, and so it started to really feel like a little cave. I started to feel a lot of anxiety, and I continue to feel that sometimes just because the lights are so bright, and it feels like, all right, the time is now. We're addressing whatever it is we're addressing all together.
And I think another unique part of the way that this is staged in the set is that I feel, and I am, being watched on all sides at all times. Mm-hmm. So something that I had a conversation with a good friend who saw the production is that we see every response that you have to what's happening in the room. And as an actor doing 8 shows a week, there's a certain amount of pressure there to be really present and listening to the same thing every single night and allowing yourself to have a truthful response. And something about that I think is unique, because often in a proscenium kind of setting, we only kind of see one side of somebody. Mm-hmm. And the lighting in this is so specific. We talked about it, but the lights are up on the audience, so you can see everyone in the room at all times, which really I think serves this piece in particular. And for me, there are moments that I feel really relaxed and like, oh right, we're all just like sitting around and chatting. And then there are other times where I feel like so vulnerable and really seen, because there's no hiding in that space.
Have you seen some strange reactions?
I don't look at the audience.
You don't look at the audience. No. Okay. How about you, Rebecca? Do you see? Well, we just talked about the little girl who screamed.
Yeah.
The day I saw. Screaming is pretty funny. It only happens rarely. I think that was the biggest one.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think, just normal behavior that people have and don't even think about usually because they're in the dark. And also, I think don't think about, especially now because we watch so much TV and there's so much screen time, people forget that live actors are indeed live and are in the room with you and can hear you. That normal things that sort of can be muted in the dark we're just extra aware of them. So somebody yawning or just like even just, you know, looking like they're bored or fidgeting with some bag or something. Like all of that feels very acute and almost like an attack.
I have a moment in my song where I go over and sing to a man at one of the tables, And it's so fun. Every night, it's different. Sometimes they want to interact with me, and it's like they want to be a part of the show. Like mm-hmm. the other night, some guy was wearing glasses, and he like took off the glasses and like leaned forward.
Because you're also wearing the tiniest little tank top yeah. that's mm-hmm. very
oh,
full.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You've got quite a push-up bra.
Oh, yeah. And what is fun is to watch how when you ask someone to kind of enter a scene with you, how they respond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I love that because it's different every night. So you never know what you're going to get. And yeah, it's a very playful moment. And also I watch like grown men get really embarrassed and really red in the face. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
I actually do look at the audience. I look at who you're looking at. That's the only time I do look
yeah,
at the
yeah,
audience.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, it's a fun moment.
We're speaking with Ali Stroker, Rebecca Naomi Jones, and Mary Testa, all starring in the version of Oklahoma that now is now playing at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn. We'll have more with these ladies in just a moment. Want to remind you that later in the show, author Tana French, who the Washington Post called the most important crime novelist to emerge in the last 10 years, she will be joining us to talk about her newest novel, Another Story of Murder and Suspense. Stay with us. All of it will be back after the break. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. I'm here with Ali Stroker, Rebecca Naomi Jones, and Mary Testa. All three star in the new production of Oklahoma, now at running at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn. It is sold out, but if you hang around and do the stalker thing, you
I have to say that there are two other women in the show, because
yes,
I know
please.
We're doing the women of Oklahoma, but there's also Mallory Portnoy, who plays Gertie with the mm-hmm. infectious laugh, and Gabrielle Hamilton, who is our dancer of the Dream Ballet. So there's actually five women.
Phenomenal.
The women of Oklahoma, yes.
And the dance sequence is phenomenal.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
And not to mention the band as well.
Oh, the band's fantastic. Oh, that's right. There are women in the band, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
So let me ask you about some of the differences. One of the things I found so interesting was the idea of Judd being sort of vulnerable and not being this big brute, sort of, I thought, like Kurt Cobain kind of style.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally.
You know, and just sort of... Some people have said he's more like an incel and another misunderstood. And tell me about how that has changed the dynamic of this play that we all know so well, mm-hmm. to have the kind of big brutish guy be somebody that seems fragile.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's Patrick's interpretation. It's the mark of a really great piece is that it can be interpreted in many different ways. And I think what Patrick is doing is stunning and bringing another element, but completely understandable element to this character. He can be a big brute, but he can also be this vulnerable outsider. And that's very much a part of what this show is about, is being an outsider and being in the circle and being an outsider. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's very much examined in this as well. So I think, you know, it's kudos to Patrick for bringing this.
Yeah. And when you were talking about circling the wagons, and it made me think about how we have talked about what it means to have a community, and especially a small town community. And I think a lot of times, in order for a community to sustain itself, it has to other someone or something mm-hmm. in order to feel like it's a strong unit. And so I think in our version of it, we're trying to explore the idea that, like, this person, we're saying all these things about him. We're saying he's bad, but maybe he's just the other.
Mm-hmm. My favorite part of what Patrick has done is that this is a troubled character, and intimidation or pain or anger doesn't have to look like a 6-foot huge, you know, burly man. And I think it is representative of how we have evolved as a culture, that like mental health is a real thing, and that's kind of how I see Judd, that he has real troubles, but he's not going around intimidating other people. They're inward, and you can see how much pain he is in those moments when he is alone, and to me that makes this piece so much more complicated and and relatable.
And I have a whole theory.
Oh, go.
I have a whole theory because I've figured out a lot of backstory on here for myself. And the backstory I figured out for Patrick, because in Lonely Room is her, as the lyric, her long yellow hair falls across my face. Rebecca does not have yellow hair.
I was going to ask about that.
my thing that I figured out, and I don't know that Patrick runs on it, is that Patrick was in love. Judd was in love with a blonde woman who did him wrong, and so he's scarred. Mm. And so he constantly finds a woman to punish.
Mm. Interesting.
That's my theory.
I had a goosebumpy moment watching him because he felt like I was watching The Days Before a School Shooter.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's then with all the guns on the back wall, too, I had that moment. I was like, I know how this actually ends, but I still have this. Well, I thought, well, maybe in this new version it doesn't. I just went
into
it.
Those people get stuck. They get stuck on something, it seems. It's like there's something that happens in their life that sends them, that turns it to 11. You know what I mean? And so, anyway, I think that's a little door into it.
Yeah.
For me, anyway, that's,
so interesting. Also, let me talk about the casting of you two ladies. Allie, you use a wheelchair. Rebecca, you have hair like mine. You're biracial, and you're playing this girl with long blonde hair. When you went in to talk about this role, did race come up? Did this come up as part of the conversation?
Not in my initial auditions. It didn't. But I know Amber Gray had played this role before when they did the show 3 years ago, and she's also a light-skinned brown girl, black girl. And so I didn't have the conversation at that time, but after I had been cast, Daniel and I met for coffee, and he has also brought it up in rehearsal that for him it's not, not speaking about me specifically, but for him the goal is not racially blind casting because he doesn't believe that can exist, and that it's on purpose to have people of color in the piece and to explore how that affects the piece and what we feel and see.
Allie, for you, it's so interesting. I when I was watching you, I thought, like, this makes sense, and your ability to. Your chair becomes part of it. I mean, watching you dance is fantastic. And it becomes, it is both not noticeable and completely noticeable.
Yeah, and that's
That's
always my goal as a performer with a disability is how do I use my disability to enhance this story and this character. And 8:00 Annie is one of these roles that it really works. And not only does it work, but I think it's really refreshing because often we don't talk about disability and sexuality that often. So it's kind of a new thing to watch somebody with a disability explore their sexuality and what that looks like. And that you don't have to mention the disability for it to be really honest and really truthful. And I have had a lot of fun sort of exploring how very often, like in love scenes, it's like when there's two able-bodied people, like, oh, this is the way you're gonna connect. And we've had to explore, like, okay, like Will Parker, like he straddles and sits on your lap, and with Allie Hackam, I sit on his lap, and what is it like, and what does it mean when a guy gets you out of your chair versus when you stay in your chair? And we've just had all these conversations, and it's been a blast for me to get to do it every single night and tell that story, because it was something that Allie has had to explore in my own life of, like, okay, like, two people who are able-bodied usually, like, hug and kiss standing up with their bodies pressed against each other. Okay, well, I'm sitting, so I can't do that. But how else do we do this? And obviously, like, I have found this in my own relationship, Allie, like, you know, how I express my sexuality and intimacy. But to do it on stage in front of 350 people every night is exciting and vulnerable and, I think, important.
And I also think the staging really lends itself. You're able to really explore the whole floor in a way. And, yeah. and I think the audience really gets to see a lot of you as a result.
Well, that's something that I was thinking about when Mary was saying, like, the set and the way that it stages sort of relaxing. But the first word that came to my head was that world feels so accessible. Mm-hmm. And so often in that kind of world where there would be like outdoors and hay mm-hmm. and whatnot, mm-hmm. like it wouldn't be as easy to get around. But we've like created this world where like it's ramps and all flat and mm-hmm. like I can roll up to any of the tables mm-hmm. and I can go everywhere where everyone else can.
Yeah.
And that to me is really exciting and also as an artist makes me feel like, oh, there isn't any limitation to where I can go,
mm-hmm.
literally.
I love when you get dipped in your chair.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost an applause moment in the show. Yeah. Everybody's so happy and joyful for it. It's just so romantic and fun.
Yeah, and we see like, oh, right, wheelchairs can like do cool things and make really neat shapes and move in a really beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an opportunity to just watch and observe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think out in the real world, sometimes we feel like we're not allowed to look or stare.
Mm.
And I think that is another cool part about this show is that we get to watch people live their lives maybe in a way that we wouldn't feel comfortable doing in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And Rebecca, did you ever, you know, as you're getting trained formally, I mean, the idea of like you playing Lori probably didn't come into your head when you were a teenage girl.
Not once.
So what does it mean for you for something like that? I mean, or that we were, a couple months ago we had, they did a version of My Fair Lady, Eliza Doolittle, down at the Bedlam.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an Indian American actress was playing Eliza Doolittle.
Wow. Mm.
Yeah. And it was just sort of interesting that I remember her telling me that, you know, it's just like, it's a role she's always liked, but she just never thought she'd play it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The other day I was doing an interview and the interviewer asked me what other classic musical theater roles, you know, would I love to do? And it's like, the funny thing is like, I was like, I've never thought about that because it's never seemed accessible to me. Mm-hmm. It's never seemed like something that would be achievable. And that's not even a bad thing. I mean, I feel like I've been really lucky to create new things that feel like I belong in them. But yeah, this has been a trip, man, because I remember when I got my audition notice, I was like, what? No, I'm not gonna audition for Oklahoma. Nobody's gonna cast me in Oklahoma. It's
Shirley
just not
Jones.
Gonna happen.
I mean,
yeah. I'm so annoyed by the way things are cast because for me, and I'm a character actor. Mm-hmm. You know, we fall in love too. We have yeah. moments too, and so I like to see. Oh, everyone get to play leading roles and everyone get to play character roles and everyone experience that. So it's wonderful. I mean, Rebecca's a leading lady, but, you know, it's wonderful when the casting is not, you know, your same cookie cutter.
I totally agree.
Leading lady. You
I
know
totally
what I mean?
Agree. But I think it's also like part of me, like as soon as I saw it was happening at St. Anne's, I was like, oh, this is going to be a mm-hmm. different kind of version of the show because part of me was also like I don't really and this no knocking the other
We're
version
knock free zone it's okay
speak at all I really mean this mm-hmm. for honestly but for me I don't personally want to just be the like brown person plugged into the version of Lori that we've seen a million times.
Exactly.
Because and yes, like more power to casting and producers and directors who are casting, you know, people of color or people with disabilities or just somebody who you wouldn't have imagined
That's
for
right.
various reasons in this role. That is amazing. And so, for example, like people seeing Lindsay Mendez in Carousel, that's so exciting for a bunch of young Latina women who are going to see her and think, wow, I can do that. That's amazing.
Right.
But that's also not for me. Like, I don't want to just sort of do the version of the thing that's been done before. Mm-hmm. And that's not always true, of course. Like
mm-hmm.
sometimes you want to do those parts, but I think it's exciting to be not only putting people who you wouldn't expect in these kinds of roles, but also exploring what they mean for us now. It's sort of exactly what Ali was just talking about. Like, yeah. What does it mean for me, and what are we seeing differently?
And something that I like go back and forth on daily is like, I don't want to be cast because I'm in a chair. I don't want to mm-hmm. be just the alternative right. kind of mm-hmm. option. But, you know, Daniel gave me one of the biggest compliments when we started, and he was like, you're here because you were the best person for the role.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that yeah. was what happened. And that's what you hope, you know, is that like, no, this role doesn't have to look like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a role that somebody comes in, and what they bring to it is the best version
exactly.
for this production.
Totally.
And that's what's so tricky about all of this new diversity movement is, it's like, sometimes I wonder, like, am I in this room because they're looking for like different kinds of people and they yeah. want to like check off their diversity boxes?
Right.
Or am I here because, you know, because I am in a chair, but I'm also a woman who is an actor,
right.
you know,
I'm good at my job.
Right. Right.
Right. So as somebody who is diverse, I fall back and forth on that all the time, because
totally.
I'm an advocate and I want to see more people with disabilities get opportunities. But then again, I also want to be cast because I'm the best person for the part.
Right. How was it to approach these sort of classic songs? You know, they're songs that are in the canon, knowing that this particular production has this different kind of bend to it. Mary, in terms of your interpretation of some of the songs, walk me through that process of, this is, you know, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning can mean a lot of different things. And it
That's
does
right.
mean a lot of different things in this production.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like, you know, you approach songs no matter what the production is in a way that you want to express what the lyric says, forward mm-hmm. the story. In this case, the orchestrations are all new. So it's a much more bluegrass sound. It's a much more countrified sound. But I think, you know, approaching these songs are the same as I would approach it in any show I do. It's just trying to find the truth and the colors and honor the music and spin it in a way that's interesting and but also has a depth to it. And, you know, I didn't approach this music any different than I approach any music that I do in any show. It's just trying to find the beauty of it. And the thing about music is that, you know, that's the most primal of the arts, I think. Mm-hmm. It hits you in the gut, kind of, and you can't kind of... There's something about a note sometimes that can be blue.
It's also physical. I mean,
that's
sound,
exactly
sound is
right.
physical. It makes vibrations,
that's
too.
That's right. And it brings you to places that you can't even speak of. So for me, it's just trying to find those kind of things, those kind of colors in it. And also, like, Many a New Day, which we did a million times.
A million different ways.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just trying to honor what was written, but also bring the truth of what you're playing and what you're doing to the music.
Mm-hmm. All right. We all know what you're doing until November, till this show is over.
November 11th, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's next for you, Ali, after this? Do you know?
I don't know. I have no idea what's coming up next. I am writing a book with a woman named Stacy, and and it's about a young girl in a wheelchair who's exploring theater for the first time.
Oh.
So that's kind of fun, a project that we are in the middle of.
Okay.
But, you know, as an actor, you know, auditioning and waiting to see what the next thing is.
How about for you, Rebecca?
I have something that's potentially happening, but it hasn't all like finished, you know, its process of being
hasn't gelled yet.
But it might be doing this indie film, but I'm not entirely sure about it.
Okay.
But the next thing I do know I'm doing, this is such a brief thing, but I'm really excited about it. My boyfriend is a playwright, and he has written a really special play about police violence called Sheepdog. It's a 2-person play, and one of the characters is an officer of color, a woman, And he is getting a production out at South Coast Rep in the spring, and we're going to be doing a workshop of it for a few days out there at the end of November. So that's the next thing I know I'm doing is this little workshop.
And finally, Mary?
Well, I am going to be doing a couple of workshops while I'm doing this.
Oh,
and the one that will sort of go the week after this closes is a beautiful, I'm a big fan of Michael John Lacusa, and I've done 5 of his shows. And this is a show called Gardens of Annuncia, which is a show about Graziella Danielle, who's one of the most brilliant choreographer directors that I know. And so I'll be working on that, the second phase of working on that. Playing actual Graziella's grandmother. So that's what I'll be doing. And then probably never work again, because that's how I always feel when a show closes.
Spoken like a true actor.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, that's it.
Mary Tester, Rebecca Naomi Jones, and Ali Stroker. If you can, get to see them in Oklahoma at St. Anne's Warehouse. It's playing through November 11th. Ladies, thank you so much for
coming.
Thank
you very much for having us.
We'll be right back after break. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Tana French is the New York Times bestselling author of 6 novels in the Dublin Murder Squad series. She has a well-earned reputation for bending and testing the limits of the crime thriller genre. In her previous novels, readers have gotten to see the ins and outs of Dublin through the eyes of Antoinette Conway, Rob Ryan, Cassie Maddox, and other detectives who poke and prod into murders and disappearances. The books explore a certain place and time in Dublin and the financial crash that crippled the country, but they also take a look at larger issues of power and identity. In French's latest novel, The Witch Elm, our narrator is not a detective, but Toby Hennessy. Toby works in PR and is the victim of a brutal assault, one that changes everything about him, how he's seen and believed by his family and friends. Stephen King calls the novel extraordinary in his review in the New York Times. And we are happy to welcome Tana French to All of It. Hi, Tana.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it is my pleasure. The first line in the book is, I've always considered myself to be basically a lucky person. Toby says this. What does that word lucky mean to Toby?
Well, for him, it means very much what it says. He basically is one of those guys who have flipped the coin the right way all the way. In every area of his life, he has been lucky. He's, you know, at shallow levels where he's, you know, he never even had chicken pox. He never even needed braces. But also at deeper levels, he's got all the components of privilege, basically. He's white, he's male, he's straight, he's cis, he comes physically, he's mentally healthy, he comes from an affluent family, he's loved, his family's stable. He's got it all going for him, right up until the night when he doesn't anymore. He surprises some burglars who have broken into his apartment, and they beat him really badly and leave him basically for dead. And when he wakes up again, he's got traumatic brain injury and he's also got post-traumatic stress disorder. So the physically and mentally healthy components of all that luck aren't there anymore. And he has to readjust to seeing not just himself, but the world around him as an entirely different place.
Before he is attacked, how does he account for his luck? Does he just assume it's his to have?
Yeah, he takes it for granted. I think he never really particularly thinks about it. And that's kind of what I was thinking about a lot when I started on this book, is the fact that luck can, it can get in the way of empathy. Because if you've been too lucky in some area, you can easily forget to think about the fact that other people might not be having exactly the same experience of the world. Or you can dismiss their experience as, well, that doesn't really count. That's not really real. I mean, the example that I've been using as my obvious one is I had a pretty happy, loved childhood. I was very lucky. But because I assumed that was the norm, I didn't really think about it very much growing up, that other people might be having a really, really different experience of childhood. And when I was sort of a teenager or so and somebody would tell me something about a childhood that was very much the opposite of mine, there'd be a part of me going, well, surely it can't have been quite that bad. They've got to be exaggerating a little bit. But not that I didn't believe them, not that I thought they were lying, but just that this was so far outside my frame of reference that my mind couldn't take in and that it was real. And I think Toby's like that about his luck. He just assumes that this is basically the way the world is for everybody. And if anybody isn't experiencing the world that way, maybe they should just lighten up a bit.
We also get a sense that on his moral compass, that arrow can wiggle a little bit because there's a scandal at his job. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, Toby, yeah, his moral compass is not so much on the moral and not so much of the compass. He works in an art gallery. He does PR. And they're working towards a show of representation of urban spaces by young disadvantaged artists. And Toby's all for this because he thinks this is way easy to publicize. But then he finds out that the guy who's in charge of organizing this exhibit has actually been faking all the paintings by their leading young artist. He made up this guy from Whole Cloth. The guy doesn't exist. He's been handing in these paintings because he feels that they won't get their proper respect if they come from a middle-class artist. They need to come from somebody who's gritty and authentic in order to get the respect they deserve. And Toby, instead of going, man, this is not okay, you are treating the experiences of your actual artists as a joke. You're treating their lives as just, you know, something that you can take advantage of in order to get recognition for your own work. Instead of doing that, he goes, cool, do you know what you should do? You should make more of those. Moral compass isn't really his forte.
So as you mentioned, he's living this sort of charmed life, and then his apartment is supposedly burglarized, and he is just beaten terribly. What is it like to write that kind of scene, or something that's so brutal like that?
Yeah, that's not easy, because especially given that this is going to have pretty serious consequences for him, you want to do that justice. There are people who are living with traumatic brain injury and with PTSD, and these are things that can devastate lives. So if you're going to write about something that leads to that, something that's so immense, you don't want to take it lightly. Like, you want to do your research and get serious about it. And I did a lot of research. But when you're writing the actual scene where he does get beaten up, in some ways you have to put all of that to one side, because he has no knowledge of anything but the actual moment. I think moments like that are so intense or so catastrophic, you sort of forget everything but what's actually going on. Nothing exists but the moment.
We're speaking with Tana French about her new book, The Witch Elm. So this main character, Toby, as you mentioned, has PTSD. He has physical disabilities. He has very difficult parts of his memory. And I'm wondering, you know, as somebody wrote about your book, that nothing in the book can be trusted. So in a way, is that to get us to empathize with Toby because he's not able to really trust his mind anymore?
Yes, exactly. He's become like I don't want to say the ultimate unreliable narrator, but almost a meta unreliable narrator, because he's unreliable even to himself. Like, he's always taken himself for granted as completely trustworthy, and the world around him as this really benign place that will always treat him well. And all of a sudden, none of that is true anymore. And for him, it's terrifying, because the danger, what's frightening in the world, isn't something he can ever escape or conquer, because it's himself. The real danger is himself. And yeah, I needed to make the world of the book an extremely untrustworthy, shifting, quicksandy place in order to have the reader having the same experience of it as Toby does.
We learn where the title comes from when Toby goes to live in the countryside with his cousins and his dying uncle. And the witch elm is a tree, but there's a bit of legend and lore behind the witch elm out in the real world, not in the world of your novel. Tell us a little bit about the unusual story of the witch elm.
Yeah, this is one of the places where the book came from, actually, is my brother sent me a link to the story, the true story of Bella in the Witch Elm, who in 1943 in a wood in England, a bunch of kids were playing and they found a human skull inside a tree, which later turned out to be a full skeleton of a woman who had been put there about 18 months earlier. Nobody knows to this day who she was or what happened to her, but graffiti started to appear around the woods saying, who put Bella in the witch elm? And again, nobody knows what happens. But my brother sent me this with a note that said, this sounds like a Tana French novel. And I mean, I didn't really know. Should I be flattered? Should I be annoyed with him? Why? But as it turns out, he was kind of right, because I was really fascinated by this story. And that clicked together with the other stuff I was thinking about luck and empathy, and somehow turned into this book. I guess I don't really know how to write a book without throwing a dead body in there somewhere to get the action moving.
What's funny, in Stephen King's review in the book of the Times, he said, too much of the plot was given away on the book flap. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm torn, because part of me goes with him. I just want the most basic premise. on a book flap, but part of me is going, there are certain things that you want to know so that you know what kind of book you're getting into, so that it doesn't necessarily come as a surprise when you're going, whoa, wait, it's that kind of book, not this kind of book. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's an open question. I can see both sides.
Is it difficult in interviews like this? Like, I don't want to give too much away, but I also want people to understand what the book's about. How do you navigate that in interviews, by the way?
I tend to just sort of answer the questions and go, as long as I'm not spoiling the ending, everything else is fine. A certain amount, like a little extra in the premise, a little less in the premise. People sort of, they know this is a mystery book. They know it's likely to be a murder mystery book. And they know that at the heart of it, I think, isn't the... at heart, none of my books are really whodunits. They're stories about somebody, about the protagonist, who finds themselves in a situation that challenges everything they either believe about themselves or want to believe about themselves. And the book isn't really a story of finding out, you know, whodunit. It's a story of finding out what this protagonist is going to do with this situation. It's more about character arc, for me anyway, than about plot arc.
We're talking about Tutana French, about her new book, The Wilch Elm. And since you're talking about character, plot, and arcs, and how your writing process, when you're writing the kind of books you write, do you have an outline? Do you know? Do you have your beginning and your end, and then you're filling in the middle? Or do sometimes you just end up going off on another road?
Oh, man, I don't have a clue. I envy these authors who have full maps. No, because they do. They know that the jigsaw puzzle pieces will fit together into something. Mm-hmm. They know there's a book there. I can't really work that way. I start off with a basic premise, a strong sense of the narrator, and like a core location. And then I jump in and I hope there's a book there somewhere. I figure it's probably because I come from an acting background. I used to be an actor. And that means that, for me, again, it is all about character. The plot comes out of the characters. So I have to write them for a while before I figure out who would do what to whom and why. So until I start, I have no idea who done it or why they done it. And it makes for an awful lot of rewriting. And I hate rewriting, but it's what works for me.
You also include red herrings. You gave a whole interview recently about red herrings. Why are they important to your work?
I think that red herrings are something that shouldn't be wasted. Hmm. At heart, this should be something that if this character is going to go off down some track that is, in plot terms, a red herring, then it needs to be something from which he or she will learn something crucial about himself or herself. This has to be a core part of the character arc if it's not part of the plot. And in this case, it is. I mean, Toby, at one stage, decides that he doesn't want to be anymore the victim, the witness, all the other roles into which he's been forced. He wants to become the active protagonist in this. Mm-hmm. He wants to be the detective, and he tries to reinvent himself as that detective. And he does go off down a bunch of red herrings and false trails because his organizational skills aren't working well, his processing skills aren't working great. He misses things that he wouldn't have missed a few months before. But for his sense of himself, all of these sidetracks and false trails are vital, and he ends up discovering things, not necessarily about the crime, but about himself, that he wouldn't have without them.
Another theme in the book is this idea of believability. Who's to be believed? Who's thought to be credible? You know, obviously that's been in the news a lot lately, especially here in the States. Was that specifically in your mind when you're writing this book, this idea of believability and who's to be believed?
It wasn't consciously in my mind, although I think at some level it's quite possible that it was subconsciously, because like you say, it's very much in the air around us, and we are all taking it in all the time, this question of who do we believe. Now, I like unreliable narrators anyway, right? Because I think they cut to the heart of what the arts are for. I mean, the arts at their heart are for giving us a few minutes, a few hours, whatever, of looking at the world through someone else's eyes, seeing somebody else's reality. And paradoxically, they never do that more intensely than when you've got an unreliable narrator involved. Because we are all unreliable narrators. We all see life through our own needs, our own biases, our own fears. And so when we end up seeing the story of a book, a play, a song, a painting, anything, through the character's biases and needs, that's when we really see reality as that character, and we really become aware that there are other realities out there, and they are as real to the people experiencing them as ours are to us. We are not the only reality. Other people's matter and are out there as well. But one thing that somebody pointed out to me that I thought was really interesting is that we're getting more and more unreliable male narrators in the crime genre in particular. And I thought that was very important because there's always been kind of a presumption that the male voice, in particular the straight white male voice, is inherently reliable, that you're talking to the default narrative there. This is a person whose narrative is to be trusted. And that anybody else, you know, the women, the gay characters, all the other characters, are in some way deviations from that narrative, and they are inherently to be questioned. And so there is some kind of statement in having a white male narrator who's unreliable.
Tana French, the name of the book is The Witch Elm. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a million for having me.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to All of Us. Join All of It. Join us tomorrow at noon on WNYC.